We head offshore now. Our next guest is a science and technology journalist and blogger, Peter Nowak, whose latest book draws the link, between war, porn and fast food and technology. He argues that cars, website logins, high-definition television and even microwave popcorn is shaped by what he calls the shameful trinity of war, porn and fast food. A Canadian, Peter lived for several years in New Zealand, where he was science and technology writer for the New Zealand Herald and a regular thorn in the side of telecom. One wonders what he makes of its latest XT travails. More on that later. But first, on the thesis of his new book, Sex, Bombs and Burgers, Peter Nowak joins us now on the line from Toronto. Good morning. Good to talk to you.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. So what is the connection between war, porn and fast food?
Well, I guess the real connection is that, you said it yourself, it's kind of our shameful trinity of needs. These are kind of our basest instincts that we just, despite thousands of years of trying to get over them and either suppress them or evolve beyond them, we just haven't been able to do it, which is kind of, it's sad in one sense, but I think the point of the book is pointing out that maybe we don't necessarily need to be so ashamed, because they have actually... These are major drivers of technological innovation and development, and they have resulted in a lot of comforts and conveniences that we don't actually, consciously think about.
How do you make the link between the technology and the beneficial technology and our passions in each of these areas?
Right. Well, it kind of depends. Each of the three areas is different. Each of these three instincts has resulted in a different industry and major industry springing up to cater to these instincts. So in the case of, I guess you could really start with the food industry. The food industry, basically every comfort and convenience that we enjoy in developed countries is really dependent on food technology. And going back to, when our societies were first forming, our countries had to stabilize their food supply. Really economic prosperity follows that. So at the heart of it is food processing techniques or food transportation and preservation and that sort of stuff. So I guess where the link between food and the military comes in is that the military is always often one of the first biggest, they have the biggest need to transport food elsewhere, right? So one of the things I talk about in the book is the Second World War. That was a first major incidence of military needing to transport food en masse, across the ocean to fight in Europe. And so, of course, many new techniques and technologies were developed to facilitate that. So there's a very strong link there, not just in supplying militaries, but food is also, or lack of food is also a major cause of war. It's a major cause of why people join armies or even join terrorist groups. When you're poor and you're destitute and you have no other options, if Al-Qaeda comes along and says, hey, join us, we'll give you food, well, your options are pretty limited. So that's the link between war and the military. The link between the military and porn is the military tends to create a lot of technologies, and the porn companies are generally often the first ones to jump on them and further them. And they provide the early dollars that lets the people who are developing the technologies further them and basically make them marketable to a larger audience.
And what examples would you give?
Well, there's numerous examples in the book, I guess. One of the earlier examples is, of course, smaller film cameras. These were, 16-millimeter, 8-millimeter film cameras. These were put to big use in the Second World War. And what happened was the technology was standardized so that it was interchangeable and easy to use, and that, of course, brought the cost of it down. At the same time, there was also thousands of soldiers trained in how to use these cameras. So once the war was over, you had this cheap new technology with many, many people knowing how to use it. So what did they do after the war? Well, some of them decided to film their children's birthdays, parties, or barbecues, family barbecues. Some of them thought they'd go professional. And, of course, what was one of the early markets that people were willing to buy amateur movies? Well, pornography. And that was essentially the birth of the pornography industry.
And once more, if you're trying to keep ahead of regulators, then the sorts of innovations that the military might be using seem to sit quite nicely for the porn industry as well. They were big users of the internet, obviously, in the very early days.
Yeah, that was one of the most interesting things I discovered in working on this book. And you see it time and time again. We're seeing it now just across the Tasman there in Australia with the government there cracking down with this plan to filter websites. And I think one of the main areas they're looking at doing is pornography sites, right? What happens is that the pornography companies, they tend to get onto new technologies quickly because governments and lawmakers, they're always hesitant to regulate new technologies because they don't want to discourage entrepreneurs and innovators from investing in them. So, you know, they tend to give them a little bit of free rein in the early days. And so that's one of the major reasons why pornography companies do go to early technologies. So as those new technologies become, old technologies and they become regulated, which is what's happening now with the internet, the porn companies start looking towards the next big thing.
And
I guess at this point is mobile phone technology and possibly some other new things like 3D or even robots.
Yes, I was going to say robotic development's another interesting area. And again, the porn industry looking to what is done in the military industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, robots is, of course, it's an area that interests me quite a bit now. I think it is the next major industry in technology. And what's happening there is that militaries around the world, not just the American military, but all sorts of militaries, they're putting a lot of effort and dollars into developing robots for obvious reasons. They ultimately save soldiers' lives. But the key in the military robot field is that the robots have to be cheap and they have to be useful, which is sort of counter to what many of the robots that have come out of Japan are. Those are some amazing robots, but they're not cheap. And really, I mean, do you really need a robot that plays a violin? It's not that handy for the average person. But a robot vacuum cleaner or a robot lawnmower is very handy. So that's what the military is learning, and that's what the companies that are supplying the military are learning. And when you take that into a sexual context, there's a huge demand for sex robots. I was at a conference in January where a man debuted what was supposedly the world's first sex robot, and this was at a pornography convention, but there was all sorts of mainstream media there. The New York Times was there, all sorts of people who normally wouldn't be caught dead at
yes. The inflatable doll has come a long way by the sounds of it. The link between weapons and looking for the positive side of our massive investment in weapons, including in weapons of mass destruction over the decades, how has that spun off with any sort of positive outcomes?
I think there's many, many examples of that in the book. The one I think I like most, and it's in one of the later chapters, is I went down to the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California, and this is one of the labs that tends to the U.S. Military's nuclear stockpile. And so their job is to, make sure that the missiles are still working, even though, without actually setting them off. So they've done a lot of work on, sort of scanner technology, and it's basically one of the world's foremost centers of laser sensors. And what they've done is they've developed something, and they've taken a method that they have used for quite some time to scan the inside of bombs using proton rays, and they've developed this into a method to treat cancer. And it's apparently a much more effective way of treating cancer than with X-rays. It was described to me as treating cancer cells with a scalpel as opposed to a baseball bat or a cricket bat, I guess, for New Zealanders. So right now this new treatment is actually quite expensive. I think the machines needed are about $200 million, and they're about the size of a gym court. So they're working on it, and they're hoping that within the next 3 to 5 years they're going to get these machines down to about $20 million, and basically room sized. So once that happens, the average hospital will be able to afford one, and we'll be able to we'll have the space for it. So what they were telling me about this whole new system is they call it revolutionary. It's not necessarily just evolutionary. And it's going to change cancer treatment dramatically because it's going to make this far superior method of cancer treatment available to the average person. So that's a great example, I think. You know, the nuclear bomb is possibly the most destructive, well, it is the most destructive, deadly weapon mankind has created, yet out of it is coming, you know, new treatment methods for what is probably the biggest killer of people.
Are you a defender, then, of the huge amount of U.S. federal spending on defense?
Sorry, am I
a defender of it?
It's hard to say. I mean, I don't think you can say the war is a good thing. That's certainly not the case. But the spending that does go into military, there's a lot of criticism of how much money is wasted on, you know, for example, say the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. But I don't think that that's necessarily wasted money. There is dividends that come out of that, and it's hard to see in the present day what they're going to be. I think what the book does a good, or at least what I hope to do a good job of in the book, is looking back at, you know, the spending that happened, say, 20 years ago, what is it resulting in now? So in that way, yes, I guess I do defend it in some ways.
It is, and history's proved it to be the case. It is sad and almost sick in what it says about us, that the Second World War was what hauled us out of a recession or indeed a depression, and in some ways that massive investment in military is often what does so.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And I think since the September 11th attacks in the U.S. In 2001, military spending has gone up dramatically. I think it's something like 75%. And, you know, right up until the recession of, I guess, just about a year and a half ago, the economy, not just in the U.S., but in the U.K. and in most developed countries, the economies rose and advanced in lockstep with that military spending.
That said, so though, we're also in massive hock and massive debt, yeah, because of it, and one wonders whether that argument holds anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you about your time in New Zealand as a technology correspondent? Because it's fascinating times for telecom here. Are you still keeping in touch with what's happening?
I do. I every now and then I check in to see what's happening and what's the latest.
It's an interesting perspective, because when you were a technology correspondent here with the Herald, you were a fierce critic of the company and of its actions or inactions. What was it that you believe it got wrong at that time before the government moved to enforce unbundling of the local loop and to force the company to consider some form of structural separation?
I think I was just talking to somebody about this the other day down there, and I think I used to speak with the minister, David Cunliffe, quite regularly before the crackdown in 2006 on telecom. And I think what the government was really hoping for, and perhaps this is a naive hope, is something that is endemic to telecom companies, telecommunications companies, whether it's in New Zealand or whether it's in Canada, United States, or wherever. I think they were hoping for an attitude change, which is the telecom business is a very expensive and difficult one to get into. So it doesn't matter which country you're in, there's very few players in the market. And I think what that's done is that's created a very different attitude towards customers that you get than in virtually any other business. I talk about the food business quite a bit in my book, and the food business is a great example, because it's the biggest business in the world, and it's the most competitive. So if you go into a McDonald's, for example, and you spill your drink, they'll trip all over themselves to replace that for you, and they'll do it with a smile. I don't think too many customers of phone companies anywhere in the world can say they've ever gotten that kind of a service from their service provider. So I think what they were really hoping for was some sort of change in attitude from the company to, you know, start treating its customers, not just its retail customers, but its wholesale customers as well, as customers, and you know, try to recognize that everybody is in this together. If your customers are happy, you can make a lot of money too, and that's, you know, maybe that's a naive hope, but I think that was what they were really genuinely hoping for.
But when you look at what's happened since the unbundling of the local loop was enforced on the company, its share price has plummeted. It's less than half of what it was before unbundling, and about a quarter of its peak. $3 billion wiped off the value of the share market shortly afterwards, and the value of shareholders' investment. Was the company right in its predictions?
In terms of share value, that's completely understandable because you had, I think, before the unbundling, you had a pretty much monopoly situation. When you, pardon the pun, but when you unbundle the monopoly, you introduce a lot of competition, or you introduce at least the threat of competition. So I don't think it's surprising that share price took a hit. Here in Canada, you know, we had a similar situation where the government stepped in. I think it was about a year and a half ago, and cleared the way for new mobile providers to come in. And you know, the existing carriers, they've taken hits in terms of how much revenue they're generating. They've had to lower their prices, you know, to match.
I'm wondering though about the impact, because if that's going to be a price that individual shareholders have to carry, then you'd like to see the results from it. Teresa Katting, the former CEO, has had a book out here recently and has argued there's been nothing like, I think 2 billion was the figure that was being touted, nothing like that investment in broadband by telecoms competitors. So has the pain been worth the gain?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wish I could say on a practical level what the effects have been, but obviously I haven't been there for a couple of years, so I don't know what the speeds and the prices of and options and choices in broadband are right now. But I do know that, you know, some of the numbers that we looked at, and I imagine are still being looked at, are the OECD statistics about, you know, where New Zealand ranks in terms of the developed world, where its broadband ranks. It has moved up a number of spots. I think back before the unbundling, New Zealand was something like 22nd out of 30. Now it's 18th out of 30, which is a few steps of improvement. Again, I don't know if that's what the actual practical effect of that has been.
The other interesting thing I'm wondering if it's made headlines offshore has been the XT debacle. Now, this is under a new former, a new chief exec, the former British Telecom boss, Paul Reynolds, under his era. Is that making headlines in fair Canada, and are you aware of it?
It's not something we would hear of normally, but like I said, I do try to keep abreast of this stuff. So XT, correct me if I'm wrong, but that was essentially their conversion to GSM or HSPA network. Is that right?
You've lost me. It's the new mobile, network that's supposed to bring.
Yeah, that's compatible. So it's compatible with Telstra in Australia, right?
Cannot answer that. But it's the new mobile network that's been introduced and was supposed to give us much better coverage and everything else, and has had a number of network breakdowns. Alcatel-Lucent, the contractor involved in this, calling it its number one priority in the world when it sent its managers over here to begin to deal with it.
Yeah, I've read a little bit about it, and some of the things I've read is that they might have gone too quickly on this conversion, and I think maybe they did it because they were pressured from, because Telstra did a conversion in Australia too. So I think they were sort of taken by surprise by Telstra's conversion, how quickly Telstra did it, and they needed to get it going as you know, to match the time frame too. I'm not sure. This is only what I've read, and I've also read that Alcatel-Lucent is maybe has not been up to the task. I don't know how much experience they have with these sorts of networks, but Alcatel-Lucent, or Alcatel anyways, has been the telecom's longtime supplier. So maybe it was just an error of judgment in which supplier to go with.
Do you have this kind of issue in Canada? Does everyone seem to have it in for whatever phone company it is? Is there quite even competition in Canada, or does there remain one large player when it comes to the infrastructure anyway?
Yeah, it's hitting the phone and cable companies in Canada's national pastime as well. but we have different problems than New Zealand. Our problem is that we have pretty strict rules against foreign ownership of telecom companies. So, you know, if something like Vodafone in New Zealand is just unheard of in Canada. Vodafone, of course, is British, and they have, I think they're in 24 or some odd countries like that. All of our mobile companies are domestic, and you know, because they have this walled garden in Canada, they've grown pretty comfortable here, and they haven't ventured outside of Canada. We had a very recent controversy where we did actually get a new wireless company that was funded by an Egyptian company called Orascom, and our regulator actually prevented them from starting up. Said, "Well, no, you're too foreign influenced." And the government, which is supporting less restrictions on foreign ownership and more competition, they actually had to step in and overrule the regulator and say, nope, they're Canadian enough for us. Play ball.
Oh, it'll keep you writing for many years to come. Thank you for being with us, Peter Nowak. His new book is Sex, Bombs and Burgers, How War Porn and Fast Food Created Technology as We Know It. The robots in the porn industry are a bit scary, aren't they? And he is also, of course, a former technology writer for the New Zealand Herald, left the country a couple of years ago and went back to his native home.